cursed to keep her kisses to herself, Greer finds her heart torn two ways. Had the warning meant to prevent calamity, or was it simply to protect her own heart? Soon, Greer, Ash, and Embry find themselves walking a path long destined by fate. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. Today, we continue on with the second half of American Queen by Sierra Simone. If you haven't heard last week's episode, I'll recommend you give it a listen, but I'll give a quick refresher. Our story today is written in the first person from the perspective of Greer Galloway. She's the granddaughter of a former vice president, and as such, she's rubbed elbows with the most powerful people in Washington. The first of these is a man named Merlin Reese, who I'm guessing is a political advisor. He once told Greer to keep her kisses to herself at the age of 7, and who knows why. He has been helping bring the young war hero, Maxon Colchester, known to us as Ash, to high political status, all the way to the Oval Office. Ash and Greer have crossed paths twice. Once she was 16, and they shared a forbidden kiss out at a party, and once when she was 21, when she saw him at an event with his new fiancé. That was the night she met Embry Moore, Ash's best friend and at the time future vice president. It's safe to say that Greer had been crushing hard on Ash, and when the engagement became public and she saw for herself, Embry unwittingly threw her a lifeline and she took it. But despite giving him all the clues that she wanted to see him again, she had never heard from him again. That was until 5 years later, our present day, Embry had showed up asking to take Greer to dinner. He had one mission, to invite Greer to meet Ash. While Ash had been happily married, he had never forgotten Greer, and since his wife had died a year ago, he had thought about her all the more. Greer agrees to see Ash, and he confesses to her that he'd never forgot her, and if she would, quote, be his. She says yes, and they enter into a dance of domination and submission. While Greer is thrilled to finally be able to reconcile her feelings for Ash, she does wonder what will happen next. And that's our story so far. The next thing I need to mention is that this is a retelling of the King Arthur story. If the name Merlin wasn't a big enough clue, there's lots of little connections to that particular mythos. For example, Greer herself seems to be an Arthurian-lit scholar, and a good number of the people in Ash's life share the names of several knights of the Round Table. Something that I didn't mention last week is that, depending on the story, Arthur has had multiple wives, at least three, all somewhat sharing the same name. Wikipedia tells me that it's in the Welsh versions from the 13th century, but that's all I really know about it. We can surmise the name of Ash's first wife, Jenny, is not a mistake. Here's hoping Greer is the second and last wife, because the stories imply that she might be doomed as well. Greer also has a very toxic best friend slash cousin, Abilene. She's the kind of girl who will scratch your eyes out one moment and then love bomb you the next. It's an abusive relationship no matter how you slice it, and Greer can't bring herself to end her friendship with her cousin. I can't be sure, but I think Abilene is our Mordred, but I'm not well enough versed in Arthurian lore to be positive. In my defense, when you have something as fluid as the King Arthur legend, anything could be anything, but that's also a reason why there are so many retellings and reworkings of this particular myth. It's basically a blank canvas with several well-known archetypes. We will pick up our story with Greer waking up the morning after a very intense night of some BDSM play with Ash. He himself is surprised that he slept at all, since sleep is hard for him to come by ever since his first tour of duty. They hear poor Belvedere begging Ash to get out of bed, he is the president after all, and begrudgingly they begin their day. And by begin their day, I mean they get into the shower together, where Ash orders Greer onto her knees and then stroking himself until he comes into her hair. I guess whatever gets you going. I mean, some people enjoy their coffee. But this is a little odd, to me anyway. I've heard of a pearl necklace, but I'm not sure if I've heard of a pearl hairband. Greer wishes that they had more time to explore themselves further, but she remarks to herself that he won't have that kind of time for, well, a very long time. She calls herself a 10-minute mistress while he is married to the nation. I'm hoping that this means that she's made peace with his commitments. It will be hard for her otherwise. He has the good manners to wash her hair for her, and thankfully he's actually rather good at it. After the shower, Ash gets dressed and orders Greer onto the bed. He regrets that he can't give her more time and that he doesn't want her to be a secret. When she tells him that she doesn't want to be a secret either, he invites her to a state dinner next week. Oh, by the way, this whole conversation is happening while Ash has his fingers inside of Greer, and she is so very, very close to getting off. However, Ash introduces another classic of BDSM play into the mix, and that is orgasm denial. He forbids her to have any orgasm of any kind, and if she goes to the state dinner, he will let her come afterwards. A few days pass, and Greer has decided to come clean to Abilene about Ash. If we remember from last week, Abilene has been vocally very obsessed with him, and so Greer, fearful of her friend's potentially devastating retaliation, never said anything about her crush on the war hero. Greer goes to meet Abilene at her company, Corbenic Events. I only mention the name because it's a reference to the castle that housed the Holy Grail, and I thought it was a nice touch. When Greer tells Abilene about her kiss all those years ago, and that she started a romance with Ash, Abilene is surprisingly chill about it, and about the fact that Greer had even caught Embry into the mix. Now, she might not be angry, but she seems to have a warning for her cousin. Just this, Greer, that men like them have secrets. You don't get to be that powerful, that young, without some big skeletons in your closet. And I guarantee you that the president and Merlin Reese would be willing to do anything to keep those secrets contained. Anything. I feel you know something I don't. If you're dating the president, you'll find out soon enough, she says, and there's something cruelly gleeful about her voice. And I think some women might be able to live with his past, but you're not one of them, honey. No, Abilene isn't jealous at all. Not one bit, no siree. Greer gets back to her townhouse, where she is surprised to find none other than Merlin Reese waiting for her. Obviously, she demands to know how he got in, and he tells her that he used to live here. Her grandpa Leo had lent it to him before she'd moved in. But he is here today to tell her a story. And this scenario is straight out of Arthurian canon. President Leo, Grandpa Leo's running mate, had fallen in love with a married woman. For years she had resisted his advances, but one night, as the caretakers were cleaning up the night's dinner for a summit, the caretaker's young son noticed how despondent President Luther had looked. He went up to Luther and said that he could lead him to the woman's balcony where no one would see them. There, Luther was welcomed into the woman's bed, and she became pregnant. Unfortunately, she died in childbirth, giving birth to this little boy, leaving behind a daughter and a husband who she was in the process of divorcing. Luther, of course, could not accept the child, so he went into the foster system while the widower kept their daughter. And yes, the little boy who had led Luther to his heart's desire was Merlin. No guesses as to the identity of the little baby boy. Merlin was telling her this because this story had become known to still unidentified individuals, and it will at some point become public. When it does, Greer should expect to end up in the crossfire. She asks if Ash knows the story, and Merlin confirms that he does. He learned it on the day of Jenny's funeral, told to him by his half-sister, raised in bitter resentment by her father, and it was her that had leaked the story to who knows who. All right, place your bets, folks. How many of us are going to guess that the sister's name is Morgan? Greer wonders if this is what Abilene was hinting at, but Merlin tells her that there's more. However, it is not his secret to tell. He does apologize for his past behavior to her, telling her that she had and still has the power to hurt Ash, even if she doesn't intend to. He was simply doing what he could to get Ash to where he is today. A few more days pass, and it's time for the state dinner. Greer makes her way to the residence, where she walks into an unexpected moment. Looking like a prince or a movie star in his crisp black tuxedo, he's sitting on the sofa, leaning forward, long legs bent, power coiled in his body. And Embry, also in a tuxedo, is in front of Ash, sitting on the carpet. It's clear that both of them were engaged in a serious conversation. There's a furrow in Ash's brow and a cast of unhappiness to Embry's shoulders. But that's not what stops me in my tracks. because Embry isn't just sitting in front of Ash, he is kneeling. Kneeling in front of Ash the same way I would, between his outstretched legs, caged in by the shiny black dress shoes planted on the floor. Kneeling in front of Ash as if it's the most natural place in the world to be. See, this is the kind of stuff I signed up for when I started this podcast. Romance outside the mainstream and brought forward so that others might see it too. Obviously, something is going on between Embry and Ash, and given Greer's interaction between both men, we all know where this is going. I just needed to get there faster. After a brief moment of a mental frozen, oh shit moment from all three parties, Ash breaks the tension when he is all smiles at Greer's entrance. Greer is fighting with herself. She is wholly here for Ash, but Embry is all that temptation wrapped up in once. He hadn't left the floor, just lounging on the carpet like Jeffrey Goldblum in a tux. They both comment on how pretty she is, and then Embry excuses himself, giving Ash and Greer some private time. Time that Ash uses to rile up Greer just enough that dinner will be pure torture. Before dinner, people have to mingle, of course, and Greer does what she can to go mostly unnoticed. Unfortunately, noticed she is, but she is able to navigate these treacherous waters. I'm glad to see this point. Yes, Greer might seem a typical romance heroine, not terribly politically powerful, modest job as a literature professor, hopelessly in love with a hero. These ingredients would supposedly make a heroine struggling to blend into the powerful and high society circles where the hero resides. Greer has no such problems, because she knows these waters. She may seem typical, but her past life experiences have ensured that she knows how to play the political game. So really, I'm thankful that I don't need to watch Greer struggle. Dinner starts, and Greer herself is thankful when the food arrives so she can give the small talk a break. However, that serenity is shattered when her seatmate bluntly asks her if she has fucked Maxon yet. Those are her words, I swear. Greer tells her it's none of her business, which earns the reply, "That means no." A glance at the woman's place setting gives Greer her name and, us the reader, all we need to know about this woman. Morgan Le Fay. Hey, found the sister. And it's spelled L-E-F-F-E-Y. I don't know if it's supposed to be pronounced differently, so I won't bother. Greer doesn't have enough to paint the full picture, but when Morgan asks if Ash has done the BDSM thing with her yet, Greer is reeling, wondering if Morgan had that place once before. Morgan can see Greer's distress and promises that, again, her words, that she and Ash are done fucking for now. I'll mention that Morgan is using his given name, Maxon, but for clarity's sake, I'm going to use Ash. Also, I don't like the implication that Morgan and Ash slept together because, no. Morgan isn't pulling any punches, calling Greer's feminism into question if she's happy to be whipped by Ash. How can she face the Democrats like this, given her grandfather's political affiliation? Greer quips that she changed her affiliation to the President's Party. A third-party candidate won the presidency? Now I really know that this is a fantasy. They continue quips back and forth until Morgan drops the hint that she knows the skeletons in Ash's closet, and that he must be getting tail somewhere if he's not getting it from Greer, because no man can wait that long to get what he wants. Before she can really lose it, Greer feels a hand on her shoulder, and it's Embry to the rescue. He politely informs Greer that Morgan is his sister, and she icily corrects him as his stepsister. I honestly didn't see that coming. We also find out that Morgan had switched her place in order to sit next to Greer, and Embry is all protectiveness. He knows how toxic Morgan is, or can be, and he's able to get Greer in a way, in a manner socially acceptable. As they walk away, Embry assuages Greer's fear of any connection between Ash and Morgan, promising that nothing had happened since their fling 14 years ago. Greer isn't sure, but Embry insists that it's the truth. As a proper gentleman, or knight if you prefer, Embry delivers Greer to Ash for the first dance and claiming her for the second. After a quick introduction to the Polish president, the dance begins and the flirting commences, but it's not long before Ash divulges his past with Morgan. While they haven't had physical sex in 14 years, he admits that they have been sexual together. Now, this is a distinction that I find interesting. Sex can be more than just insert tab A into slot B, especially considering that there are lovers out there who might have any grouping of tabs and slots. So where does sexual end and sex begin? More than likely, this is dependent on who's making the definition. In the first half of the novel, Greer and Ash have an encounter that ended with both of them having orgasms, but they didn't participate in typical penetrative sex. Was it sex, or was it a sexual encounter? I think I might say it's sex, but your mileage may vary. When Ash says that he was sexual with Morgan, he's describing the aftermath of his wife's death. He was on the campaign trail, deeply struggling, and Morgan was there to get him back on track. Aside from their fling 14 years ago, they were already quite familiar with each other, what with Morgan being Embry's stepsister and all. So in the middle of his grief, Morgan grabbed him and brought him to a sex club that she often visited. This leads to the conversation about Ash's tastes, how they run rather extreme, accentuated by his time in combat. He admits that he tried to bury it as best as he could with Jenny, but it often at night, Ash's thoughts would drift to Greer. To his credit, he knows that this isn't a good look. He devoted himself to Jenny, completely, but sometimes thoughts run where they run, and Ash's thoughts ran to Greer. But as for being sexual with Morgan, that sex club was where he got proper training to be a safe dominant, and Morgan was the sub with which he practiced. They never had physical sex, but if someone considers BDSM as sex, it might be seen differently. Greer isn't bothered by this story, but she is concerned about his reputation. Luckily, the club caters to more than a few high-powered folks, and if an NDA is violated, well, it will be hell. I'm also astounded that they have this intensely intimate conversation out in the open. Yes, hushed voices hide many sins, but I would not be comfortable with this sort of talk in any public sphere, especially a political one. As sex positive as I am, there is a time and a place and a state dinner and dance, ain't it? They are then approached by Kay Colchester, Ash's foster sister and chief of staff, alerting him about military movements on the Carpathian border. Ash goes into president mode, preparing for the Situation Room and planning calls to Ukraine and Poland. Greer knows that even if they had plans after the dinner, matters of state take precedence, and she's okay with leaving if he asks. Ash insists that she stay, however, and has Belvedere escort her to the residence. Once she's there, she gets a text message from Ash with strict instructions. Get undressed, freshen up, put on one of his button-down shirts, and wait for him kneeling on the middle of the floor. It's almost immediately uncomfortable. The carpet presses into my knees with hundreds of fibrous little twists, and the muscles in my arms strain with the ache of holding them in such an unfamiliar position. A thousand million itches spring up on my skin, and every tiny sensation, thirst, the slightly too cool air of the room, the faint hunger left over from my half-eaten dinner, is magnified and made all-consuming. I can't use my phone to distract myself. I can't even use my eyes to distract myself. There is nothing between me and being inside my own body. No other person, no other thoughts, no work or family or friends or responsibilities. There is only me and one directive: to wait. I was pretty lukewarm on the idea of reading an erotic romance in the first person, but here it shines. Greer has no other choice but to exist within herself, and so that's what she does. Okay, she has a choice, of course, but you know what I mean. And she waits a while. She knows that this is what will please him, and that makes it all the easier for her to sit like this. Finally, since her eyes are lowered as instructed, she is thrilled to see a pair of men's shoes appear in the doorway. And then not so thrilled when she sees a second pair. Ash says she can look up, and she is met with both the sight of him and Embry. Embry looks as panicked as she feels, but Ash doesn't comment on it at first. He thanks her for her trust, telling her that he made sure that no one else came up here. Rather rich when Embry is standing right next to him. He says he still needs to make a couple of phone calls and needed Embry with him, but he didn't want to leave Greer alone any longer. You see the problem. Greer offers to wait somewhere else, mostly because she doesn't want Ash to see how much she likes Embry see her like this. This is the kind of thing that should have been brought up beforehand, not sprung up mid-scene. Ash should have approached this topic when they weren't playing together to get a read on how it would go. Ideally, Embry would have been present for that conversation, but that's the real-world scenario. We are in a fantasy world now, and things are different. And Greer always has that safe word. This is their reality. So let's not confuse their reality with ours. Talk about these kinds of things with your partners, okay? Ash says that they'll take the calls on the sofa, and while Embry resists a little at first, he moves and obeys in a way that suggests to Greer that they might have done this before. Ash then orders Greer to crawl to him. She also resists, telling him Embry is here and that he'll see her. Ash does the right thing, a check-in to see if she needs to use her safe word, trusting her to voice her boundaries. It's that trust that allows Greer to move forward, so she does as she's asked. He sits her on his leg and tells her to pleasure herself however she needs in order to get to an orgasm, but she has to be quiet since he and Embry will be on the phone. I think this might count as exhibitionism, but again, definitions might vary. As Ash takes a call from the ambassador to Ukraine, Greer obeys once again. This scene is pretty wild to me because for all intents and purposes, this is a serious matter. It required a briefing in the Situation Room, and now Ash has Greer in a very precarious position while he checks base with some of his people. Sure, he doesn't go into classified information, but it's still kind of insane. The phone call ends, and Ash ramps up the intensity, taking off her shirt after he asks Embry if he'd like to see more of her. Then he turns around so Embry can have that better look. The phone rings, and he and Embry have to turn the politics back on while Greer has at it. And she finally gets the orgasm she has been craving right after that second call ends, after which Ash commands her to give him an orgasm of his own. With a lot of the raunchier books we've read, the sex scenes don't last very long. Pun not intended. Once or two have gotten their endings, we might get references to additional sex without visual confirmation, but here it keeps going. Ash is pushing Embry's limits, so he knows that Embry is struggling with his own arousal, so he orders Embry to take care of himself, using Greer's dress to do it. Like I said, everything about this is intense, and even after Embry leaves, there is still more between the two of them. Not as play-by-play as we've gotten, but it's still very descriptive. And through it all, we haven't seen them get into penetrative sex yet, as Ash has waited to wait before they finally get there. So again, we pose the question, what is the difference between sex and sexual? And again, I say it's determined by the person making the judgment. In my opinion, what happened between Ash and Greer was sex, even if it wasn't penetrative. But with Embry, it was sexual. He didn't touch either Greer or Ash, but he was still present in their scene. 6 weeks pass, and it's Christmas Eve. Ash, Greer, and Embry are all enjoying the holiday at Camp David, and if the previous scene was the raunchiest thing I might have read for this podcast, this is certainly giving Wholesome a run for its money. After some time making popcorn garlands, Embry falls asleep, and Ash asks Greer to join him for a walk. Ash seems to be in a somber mood, and Greer is frightened that he is about to end everything. But instead, he asks for her thoughts on original sin, or rather, sins of the father. She's not sold on it, and he continues on, saying that this is about Morgan and his own father. He knows that Merlin told her the story of his conception, but that he never told Greer the name of the woman who gave birth to Ash. Imogen Le Fay, also Morgan's mother. And all my fears of incest were confirmed, but Ash promises her that he had no clue at the time and doesn't know if Morgan had any idea. But these were the rumors that everyone had been alluding to, that everyone had warned Greer about. And if anyone is disgusted, no one more than Ash himself. Because of his ignorance, he had no clue about his relation to her, not until she told him at his wife's funeral. Can we move on from this? I am uncomfortable. Ash also talks about why he thinks Morgan hates him, besides, well, everything else. While he was fighting in the Carpathian War, an already messed up situation for Ash, Morgan had come to Prague to visit his base. In a horrible Sophie's Choice scenario, Ash had to choose between rescuing children placed on a burning boat or rescuing hostages in a church, one of those being Morgan. As Ash and his squad rescued the children, the opposition had shot all of the hostages, using the children as a distraction. Morgan had been the only survivor, and when she found out what Ash had chosen to do, he surmises that she never recovered from that knowledge. Yeah, sounds like a war. Greer is incredibly understanding, even with the thing about Ash accidentally boinking his half-sister. I mean, he honestly didn't know, and he noped the hell away that the moment he did. I don't know if there's a basis in Arthurian canon for this type of relationship between Morgan and Arthur. I just know that they're half-siblings. I'm leaning towards no? So I'm curious as to why the author chose this particular plot point. But I still repeat, this reality is not our reality, and Greer is chill with Ash's past and all the skeletons in his closet, and she tells him as much.
"Do you really mean that?" he whispers.
"Yes." It comes out clear, honest. The truth of my answer hits him like a bullet to a Kevlar vest. Blunt force, ragged exhale, fractured man. He collapses into me, his arms pulling me so close that I can feel him even through the heavy wool of our coats, and he buries his face into my hair.
"What did I do to deserve you?"
This is another one of those things that I think we need to see in media, not just romance novels, but the mainstream, and that's a vulnerable man. A man who isn't afraid to come apart in front of the woman he loves and who loves him. It's important that we can see a man who expresses his emotions in a way other than sex or violence. After Ash collects himself, he's still swept up in the emotion of it all and offers Greer a ring. She accepts his proposal and they head back to the lodge. It's a fast proposal, sure, they've only known each other for a little over 6 weeks, but in the realm of romance novels, it's pretty typical. When they get back to their room, being careful not to wake up Embry, they only have one thing in mind, and Ash is ready to go all the way this time. Greer is excited so that she drops to her knees right then and there, but Ash gives her the choice to let him serve her for their first time, giving her as much control as possible, but she knows what she is looking for as much as he knows. "You want to know what else I want? I want what I dreamed about 10 years ago. I want to be dragged to the edge of shame and fear and darkness. I want to not recognize myself, and I want you to be the glorious, demanding beast that you are. You want to take care of me? Then fucking own me. Wreck me. Tear me up and sew me back together the way only you know how." And Greer knows, she knows that when she is done kneeling, she can stand just as tall. And if it's too much, she can end everything with just the sound of his name on her lips. She isn't afraid, and Ash is all but worshipping her at this point. They start with some spanking, with Greer holding onto the footboard of the bed. And then our dear Mr. President gives her a treat with his mouth. It ramps up when he adds a belt to the spanks, and while Greer might come close to the safe word, his trust in her keeps her focused. I'd like to see a novel where the safe word is used and cherished and protected. This is the closest we've seen, but it illustrates the trust between Dom and Sub, being able to approach their play with the mantra of safe, sane, and consensual. Of course, there are those who might view BDSM as anything, but And that's fine. The example we're given in this particular novel is pretty hardcore, and it might look extreme to folks who aren't familiar with the lifestyle, but don't yuck another's yum, as they like to say. After the belt, Ash gives Greer her richly deserved orgasm, and then they finally get the sex they have been denying themselves for the past 6 weeks. Again, it's intense, but I repeat myself. When the two have come down from it, Greer comes back into her body, and she knows that she can't wait any longer to keep her secret of her first time. She tells Ash that her first time that she had sex was with Embry, and he replies with a surprising and enigmatic, "I know." He tells her that the night after she and Embry had sex in Chicago, Embry wanted to talk to Ash about this amazing girl that he had just met. Ash had also wanted to talk about a girl who he'd been thinking of, how bad he felt that she'd found out the worst way about his engagement to Jenny. When Ash had told Embry his story with the girl's name, Embry bro-coded himself so hard that he never told Ash the truth about the girl who had given him everything the night before. Ash eventually puts the pieces together and figured out that it was Embry in Greer's past. He's not mad, but certainly possessive. He approaches her with a "how did it feel" conversation, but not in anger. He takes her again, asking her what it was like, mimicking her memories. Afterwards, she tells him that there's no need for jealousy, but he knows that jealousy is not the right word for what he feels. He soothes her to sleep, telling her that they've got all the time in the world to talk about it. Hey, more communication. Excellent. Several hours later, Greer wakes up, groggy, hungry, and to an empty bed. She guesses that Ash might be working, Christmas or not, he is the president. But on her way to the kitchen, she catches Ash under the mistletoe, kissing someone. And that someone is Embry. They don't see her, and she doesn't make herself known. And she's overrun with massively conflicting emotions, swirling with a combination of jealousy, longing, and love. After Christmas, work ramps up for Ash, and Greer doesn't get any time with either him or Embry for a while. But when it's time for a public meeting between Carpathia and the U.S. in Geneva, Greer is invited to go. As a plus, she gets to bring Abilene. Well, she thinks it's a plus. I don't. That night, they get ready for the diplomatic dinner, and once again, Abilene criticizes Greer's dress of choice. Greer thinks that it's because Abilene thinks she could do better. I think we have all guessed that it's because Abilene wants her to do worse. Thankfully, Ash arrives to collect the girls, declares Greer perfection itself, and offers Embry to be Abilene's date. I think any woman would be thrilled to be on the arm of the exquisitely handsome and charming vice president, but Abilene is not any woman, and she's still clearly obsessed with Ash. So she's the one putting on a brave face for now. While the dinner is meant to be a show of good faith before the tough negotiations start, it's clear that the room is dripping with tension. Greer ends up sitting between the Carpathian president and his wife in order for Ash to be between Embry and said president. And Greer notices that the wife, Lanka, is very reserved, if not an almost shell of a person. Trained for this exact moment, Greer looks to find a language that both she and Lanka speak, and lands on German, and the two are able to have some conversation. It's clear that Lanka is in a tough spot, but warms to Greer. Once dinner is done, it's time for the dance, and as a show of diplomacy, Greer is partnered with the Carpathian president, Melwas, and Ash with Lanka. And Melwas is vile. This is supposedly meant to be a night where everyone plays nice, with the nastiness coming out as the negotiations ramp up at the table later, but he takes no time in stirring up the pot. He pushes her into dark memories for Ash, and claims that if Greer were his wife, she would never be able to speak to him the way she was now. This is a moment that I believe is supposed to put Ash and Melwas on opposing viewpoints. During their interaction, Greer knows Melwas is becoming aroused and aggressive, and some might draw similarities toward his behavior and Ash's proclivities in the bedroom. Greer herself notes as such and emits the cool and calm that only can come from having been raised as a political spy disguised as a princess. Embry, having watched it all from the sidelines, cannot stand the abuse any longer, so he cuts in. He can tell Melwas was crossing boundaries and comes close to clocking him, but something Ash said gets a giggle out of Lanka, and then the Carpathian president scurries away with his poor wife in tow. Greer does look a little shaken, and Embry talks to Ash about what just happened. Ash agrees that it was no bueno indeed, and tells Greer that she is getting double on her security detail. And Greer, we love you. It's nice to see you pull out the I can take care of myself card, and Ash is proud of you. But you're still getting a ton more protection. And I love that Ash acknowledges her independence and agency, even aligned with their dom-sub relationship. And he knows that it's not entirely Greer's fault that she lashed out at him with the mention of more security. Melwas, a powerful man or not, is a piece of garbage, and what he did basically equated to sexual assault. Ash is exceedingly understanding, and we get to watch a man devote all of the protection that he can on the woman he loves while simultaneously reassuring and elevating her agency. And let's also celebrate the fact that we've got two men in power who watched the interaction between Greer and Melwas and immediately know that it was sexual assault, no question about it. The parts don't have to be exposed for the label to stick. This interaction gave us so much, and I'm living for it. Greer takes Embry to the dance floor, asking briefly about Abilene, who had apparently ditched Embry for a man in the Carpathian delegation. Something smells here and I don't think it's roses. As they dance, Greer tells Embry that Ash knows about their past now, and they get into a deep discussion about how they feel for one another, honest feelings all on display. She probes him about their Christmas kiss, and he talks about how he and Ash got started, intimacy beginning while they were on duty together. They'd been off and on for 10 years, and now everything had been twisted up between them and Greer. And now we're finally getting some communication. Nothing gets solved in this conversation, of course, not without Ash present, but they've begun the process of figuring things out. When Greer is taken back to the hotel, security arrangements have been moved around, and she's taken to Ash's room instead of her own. They've decided that her safety supersedes the public's ire over the unmarried president with a woman in his room. Yeah, she's his fiancé, but voters are a little stupid, let's be honest. And she's angry. Her conversation with Embry lit a fire under her, and she needs to understand what the hell is going to happen now. It's hard to summarize her whole conversation. There's a lot of it, rightly so. The gist is, Ash had loved Embry, has even asked Embry to marry him, but was declined. Twice. Greer is not Ash's rebound since Embry turned him down. He loves the both of them fiercely. And now, Greer has a better understanding of their dynamic. Ash hates himself for keeping the secret, for the kiss on Christmas Eve, and he expects Greer to turn around and leave. He frowns.
You were so angry, and with good reason. I just thought...
That I'd leave you? Like Embry did?
Yes,
he confesses. I squeeze his hand. I'm angry. I need to be able to be angry sometimes. I need to be able to demand answers, but that doesn't mean I don't love you. It doesn't mean that I don't want to stay. A deep breath with the next admission. Especially because I love Embry too. He and I haven't, please believe me, Ash, we haven't touched since that night in Chicago. This is what I am talking about right here. We aren't getting emotions in the way, no misunderstandings, genuine conflict resolution and communication between our couple. I cannot yell from the rooftops loud enough to say how much I adore this passage. They aren't sure where the next step is, though, but Ash takes the opportunity to ask if Greer was curious. When she admits that, yes, she'd be wondering what it would be like with the two of them together, he plays a little pretend, and they have some classic makeup sex. Afterwards, they discuss some ground rules going forward, that when they think of Embry, they tell each other, and neither one of them will approach Embry romantically until they can all talk. More honesty going forward. And, unexpectedly, Ash tells Greer to be careful with Abilene. She'd apparently come on to Ash, not subtly either, and Ash is convinced Abilene holds some resentment towards Greer. I mean, yeah, we all knew that. During the next days and weeks, Ash, Greer, and Embry really never get a chance to square things away with each other. Running a country and planning a highly public wedding tends to sap a lot of time from people. When the day of the wedding arrives, Ash follows all tradition. He doesn't want to see Greer until she's walking down the aisle. So as Greer gets ready, she's swirling with conflict. She knows that her love for Ash is too intense to leave him behind, but she feels that their marriage will mean that they both will lose Embry. As she is fighting both joy and sorrow, she gets a visitor. And it's Embry. She remembers what she promised. She wouldn't do anything with Embry until they've had a chance to talk about things, but Embry is someone on the phone who wants to talk to her. It's Ash, and he says that he has a present for her, the best present that he could give his bride. Greer says that she doesn't want to hurt him, but Ash replies that it's pain to see her and Embry apart. It hurts to see with Embry with other women, so this way he can bring pleasure with the pain. While Ash listens on the phone, commanding Greer to describe what's happening, Embry uses his hands and mouth to give Greer the most insane wedding gift that I think anyone could give. I'm happy for her, truly, but I really hope Embry didn't mess up her look too much. She's the talk of the nation right now, probably, and everyone is going to be watching the wedding with eagle eyes. Thankfully, the wedding goes off without a hitch, like we saw at the beginning. And while Embry claims a small illness to escape the festivities, Ash and Greer agree to have him join them tonight, to see where it all will go. After that big ol' raucous party, they get into the limo and head towards their hotel. Abilene shot off a text to Greer to see where they were staying, since these things might change at the drop of a hat, and she wants to know that they've arrived safely. If this were any other book, any other, this detail is inconsequential. But we aren't in any other book. This is the story about the president, his new first lady, and the toxic best friend who was seen canoodling with someone from a hostile nation. The same toxic best friend who might be the Mordred character in our Camelot remix. This does not bode well. They arrive at the hotel, and Ash has invited Embry to their room. He welcomes him with a kiss, and Embry isn't sure what's going on exactly. Ash and Greer explain to him how much they all love each other, and how they need to decide, here and now, if Embry wants to join them. He's not sure at first, saying he doesn't want to be a third wheel, and he's assured that he won't be. It's the conversation we've been begging for since the start, and I could not be more excited. Finally, something outside the heteronormative mainstream that we have been wading through. It's poly, it's queer, it's incredible. Ash and Embry declare Greer in charge, and she wants to see what it's like when they do more than just kiss each other. And boy, do they ever. When they've gotten their pleasure with each other, they ask Greer for what's next. She says she knows that it'll be rough and tumble for a lot of their sex, but tonight, she wants to feel special and cherished like a bride. It's her wedding night, after all. As Embry has been in couplings that included two men and one woman, Ash takes him to the other room for a, consultation. When they get back, it's all about Greer. This scene is, well, it's a lot. I'm sure for Greer, it's practically overwhelming, and I'm going to tell you, honestly, that if you want the full deets, go read the book. I've pushed the limits for this review, both in terms of content and length. So yeah, go read the book. Like, right now. I'll still be here when you get back. After it all, they cuddle, and it looks like it's happily ever after, which should be a clue that something's about to go down. While Ash and Embry are sleeping, Greer gets a text from Abilene in the middle of the night, saying that she needs to see her in the lobby. It's urgent. Greer gets out of bed, and something feels off in the hallway. She doesn't see the agent that's supposed to be posted by the elevator, but before she can get back inside the room, it is too late. There's a man dressed in a hotel uniform, but she recognizes him from the Carpathian dinner, and he takes a step towards her. This is not me dragging out the book for a third episode. I wouldn't do that to you. The book itself is a cliffhanger. The trouble with going into these books mostly blind is that I had no idea there would be a sequel, and I get absolutely wrecked when it ends like this. It's a first for this podcast, a romance novel that was not finished by the end of the book. And it's a testament to the book that I immediately want to run out and get the next one in the series, which I will be doing, don't you worry, but I gotta space stuff out, you know? Still, there are two Heathers fighting in me right now. Heather the podcaster, who knows that things are planned in certain ways and need to happen when they are scheduled. And Heather the greedy book dragon, who wants to read the other novels in this series right now. Like, for myself. It had everything. But before I lose myself in praise, let's get into Heather's final score. I wasn't lying when I said that I love this cover, and so the cover is going to get a 5 out of 5. It's excellent. It did its job, by which it caught my attention in the bookstore and got it to come home with me. I wouldn't change anything about it. Drama is another 5 out of 5. Loving the President of the United States means that not only is Greer in the middle of her own life and its pitfalls, but also in the middle of the problems of an entire nation. The relationship between Ash and Greer is molded and shaped by his status as president, and it matters every second, right up to the very end. Then we get an unexpected personal drama, adding Embry into the mix. The tension between all three of them could be summed up as exquisite pain, resulting in a cathartic resolution on Greer's wedding night. Romance is going to be a 4 out of 5. Typically, the speed at which Greer and Ash got engaged would be enough to drop the score lower, but something held up that number, and that is communication. Sure, they weren't able to solve all of their problems in single conversations, but that's perfect, because that's how it works. Ash and Greer understood that it's not them versus each other, it's them versus the problem. They take their time making sure that boundaries aren't crossed and owning up to their mistakes. And when they added Embry into the mix, it felt organic because they all loved each other. Spice Level is a blazing 5 out of 5. I saw a review that described this book as filthy, and I tell you what, it lives up to its reputation in the best of ways. It brought us moments that I had never seen before, and the whole while we were getting a picture-perfect description from that first-person narrative. It pushed the boundaries of what I'm comfortable talking about on the show. Not that I'm a prude, certainly not, but I do have a tone that I'm going for, and play-by-play pornography ain't it. Now, when it comes to BDSM, there are places they didn't go where I expected. But knowing Ash, considering that this is a series, we might get there anyway. Still, this book was so spicy that some colonizing monarchy somewhere set sail in search for it. Realism is weird, and I'm going to say that it's a 3 out of 5. There's a lot that I can see happening in the real world, namely the political power plays. And separately, I can see the relationship between these three people developing in a believable manner. Mash the two together and it starts to rub against my suspension of disbelief. The American political scene is absolutely ruthless, and considering the shenanigans that Ash got up to, it's hard to believe that no one outside his personal circle notices. Then we get the influences from the Arthurian canon, and that's the hardest part to scrutinize for realism. And there's the whole fact about a third-party candidate running for and winning the presidency, so that's the biggest fantasy that so far only exists in my dreams. So at the end of all, what did I think of this novel? Personally, this gripped me in a way that hasn't happened in a long, long time. There's not much more that I could say about it, except go out right now and buy this book. I don't care how. This was intense, spicy, and queer, and we desperately need more of it on mainstream bookshelves. So for my final score, American Queen will get 5 Arthurian War Hero Presidents out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hyun Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an HFK production, and it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.